Okay, that ends our formal presentations. Now it's time for question and answers, and I encourage all the other speakers to join in whenever they want if they got something to add. Daniel, why don't I start with you? You ended your discussion with the relationship between Russia and China. And going back to the role that Henry Kissinger played in both Robert's and Graham's discussion, what Kissinger was trying to accomplish was to split China and Russia in his initial overtures to China. John Mearsheimer, in his discussions with us previously, highlighted it made sense for American containment of Chinese power to ally itself with Russia, even if it meant undermining ties with Europe. Can you comment a little bit more about how we could split China and Russia and how energy plays a role, or is energy going to be the way that China and Russia actually come together even more closely?
I would say fat chance. I mean, I hear that in Washington, people saying, how can we get Russia? We can't. We're just putting more sanctions on Russia. There are reasons for it. But there's no reason. I mean, Putin, if Biden becomes president, what will that mean? That he's seen five American presidents come and go. He sees his future in the East. And the policies that we're pursuing with both China and Russia will only drive them together. And they would not, you know, that, you know, we put sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, $11 billion pipeline, 3 weeks before completion. That's not going to pry them apart. So I think I hear that, and I think that's being asked in circles, Democratic circles today. I'd say it's a fantasy.
I agree 100%.
Can I jump in here? It's Robert. Yeah, I would just say, remember, when Henry Kissinger and Nixon split China and Russia, that was 1971, and the Russians and Chinese had literally over a million troops on their border. They were on the verge of war. They had actual battles. So that time, you know, that was a time that's incomparable to today. You know, splitting China from Russia then was eminently doable. It was just the tactics that the Nixon administration exercised so brilliantly. Now it's completely different. It's not eminently doable.
Let me, you know, if I just offer one line on this, I agree with both of them strongly. Spik Brzezinski had a nice thought, which I wrote an article about last year. You can look it up on the China Russia Entente. They called it the Alliance of the Aggrieved. So American policy has actually played a significant role in the development of the relationship between Xi and Putin. They're best buddies, and when they get together, the first thing on their agenda is the Americans who are trying to undermine our solid autocratic regimes.
So there's your answer, Larry.
Yeah, I guess so. Graham, just to kind of follow that up, it seems that the tools that the United States is going to bring to bear to contain Chinese military and political power, they'll take a page from George Kennan's work and from their experience with the Soviet Union. And they're going to try, and I think it's going to be a mutual feelings between Chinese neighbors in working together with the United States. I'm thinking particularly India, Australia, and Japan, maybe South Korea, in that foursome to contain Chinese power. How do you think about that melding of interests, and will that be successful, or, as you mentioned, will it cause a potential for war as one of those four partners may get into some sort of a disagreement with China, and that could escalate into a world war?
A great question. So I think the place to start briefly is with the so-called balance of power, or what I would describe it as a seesaw of power. So what's happened in terms of economic power? China has gone from about 10 or 20% of U.S. GDP in 1990 to 100% in 2014 to 120% today, on the way to 150%. That's measured by purchasing power parity, which is the yardstick that the CIA uses. So secondly, China has become the largest trading partner of everybody. So at the beginning of the 21st century, we were, of all of Asia. Today, if you look at it, China is overwhelmingly. So attempting to organize a new Cold War in which people choose unambiguously between China and the U.S. is not going to align many people on our side. As our friends out there say repeatedly, don't try to make us choose between our economic relationship with China, which is essential for our prosperity, and our security relationship with you, which is essential for our safety. So this is a much different version of an effort to try to get on our side of the seesaw, because we certainly need some more heft, people, the allied and the aligned. But each of them, as you say, will come with its own interests. And one of the difficulties, strings of alliance and alignment run both ways. So at the same time that we need their weight on our side of the seesaw, we need to be very cautious of the ways in which their interests are not our interest in every instance, and their interests could drag us into something that we're not seriously interested in, like a war with China.
Well, let me give you an example of how I totally appreciate the economic angle. But sometimes I think the Chinese military acts in ways that is inconsistent with maybe the Chinese overall interests. So, for example, there was some fighting going on between India and China in the last few months over some sort of a border dispute, and for the first time in a generation, people were killed. I got to imagine that those actions will end up pushing India closer in its relationship with the United States. Who else will help defend India against this great superpower? And I wonder, in the same way with the Japanese, if they are firing on a Japanese ship in the South China Sea, who is Japan going to turn to other than us? So I don't think of it as a seesaw necessarily. I think of it as, what other options do they have, and how will they think about this? In similar ways that France thought about having great trade relationships with Germany in 1914, but then, you know, becoming militarily differently as it thought about its security interests.
Well, Larry, you already see the Indo-Pacific, I guess, of Japan and India and the U.S. kind of moving into an alignment. And also, by the way, India has certainly gotten closer to us, and I've seen up close that the energy relationship with India, we're exporting oil and gas to them, has become a very important dimension of that new relationship. And the other important dimension is their concern about China, as you point to it.
The inevitable consequence of this will be pushes in one direction and pushes in the other direction. But I think the Chinese bet is that the forces of economic gravity will allow them to push further their interests, for example, in their dispute with the Indian border, or in their dispute with Hong Kong, or in their dispute, indeed, in building militarizing islands in the South China Sea. And that if you try to see who's on board for a war with China over Taiwan, pretty soon you'll find nobody that's there with you, not India. In fact, as Bob Blackwell, my colleague, likes to say, if you want to clear a room of Indian strategists in a stampede, say alliance with the U.S., and they run.
Yeah, I think...
If I can mention one other thing, for Japan, it exports as much to China as it does to the United States. So they, you know, they have to balance their economic and their strategic interests. However, they don't like the idea of China owning the South China Sea.
Robert Kaplan, there is a view among some political scientists that two ways to avoid war are for both parties to become a democracy. Democracies don't go to war with other democracies. That's one idea. And the second idea that's just been touched on is that if you have very strong economic and trade ties, it's unlikely you want to go to war against each other as well. Now, you spoke in your talk about why we shouldn't encourage democratic actions in this area, and we should stay away from ideological delusions. Is that in opposition to the democracies that fight other democracies, or is that just a recognition of, on the ground, we just you know, we got to fight our battles accordingly to our international interests.
Yeah, we can easily find a space where we support human rights, support democracy, while not raising the ideological temp, while not hitting China over the head with it every day and turning our rivalry with China, which has so many different aspects to it, cyber, military, trade, into a kind of, you know, heavy-handed debate on democracy. I spent decades as a foreign correspondent around the world, and I did not see the world divided between democracy and authoritarianism. I saw, very successful democracies and hard totalitarianisms in very few countries. Much of the world is in gray shades, where you have enlightened authoritarian rulers like Jordan, like Oman, like Morocco, and then you have illiberal democracies where dictatorship of the ethnic majority over an aggrieved ethnic minority. So we should not try to turn this into a kind of which side is history is on, democracy or authoritarianism. That overly simplifies the what's happening on the ground around the world.
Can I agree completely with this? I think the nuance that Robert is suggesting is essential, but it's also the case, again, to go back to the Thucydidean dynamic, the chapter in my book that Americans don't like the most is called What If Xi's China Were Just Like Us? And I imagine it just like us, as we preached to them, when Teddy Roosevelt was leading us into what he confidently believed would be an American century. And you watch his behavior in the first 15 years after he arrives in Washington, and I think if he were commenting on Xi's China, he would say, my goodness, is he mild? You ain't seen nothing yet. And the first he arrived in Washington, there was a mysterious explosion on the main in Cuba. We declared war on Spain, liberated Cuba, kicked Spain out of the hemisphere, picked up the Philippines. We sponsored and supported a coup in Panama, in Colombia, created a whole new country called Panama. We announced the Roosevelt Corollary, the Monroe Doctrine, which said if nations in our hemisphere, reclaiming the whole hemisphere, misbehave, we'll send the Marines to change their government. And we sent the Marines to some government every year the next 15 years. And we actually stole a big piece of the fat tail of Alaska. So the chapter there is delicious for those of you who are readers, and that's a democratic America. So I think it was if China were just like us when we were at that stage in their development, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Graham, just to follow up on that, what Robert Cabot mentioned in his talk was a solution that maybe we choose Eisenhower's middle way. And in John Lewis Gaddis's book on strategies of containment, it goes into great detail about Eisenhower's strategy. And at that time, over those island disputes in the 1950s with China, China at that point did not have nuclear weapons, and Eisenhower threatened potentially to use nuclear weapons over this island dispute. And he made that a little unclear about how he would respond, but left the nuclear option on the table. In your book, Graham, you talk about risks of how things can get quickly out of control. When you play with the nuclear option and when you play with asymmetric responses, you keep other countries on their toes. But, you may have to, do something sooner or later. Gaddis thought that the symmetrical response was worse when you actually made it aware of, what you would do. How do you think about Eisenhower's tactics and his middle way as a solution and methods to contain Chinese power?
I again agree with Robert that this is a wise course. The French made a maximum effort to try to get Eisenhower to come and the Americans to come bail him out in Indochina. He said no and resisted. It was the Democrats, Kennedy and Johnson, that Americanized a war in Vietnam that was our biggest foreign policy mistake, of the period, maybe even bigger than the war with Iraq. So he had a very good sense that military power was crucial, but that it needed to be very cautiously exercised. The second thing is, he understood he didn't want a war with China. He had resisted war with China when the Civil War was going on. There was an axiom that he believed: Americans cannot fight on the Asian mainland. They have too many people. It's too complicated. And, most importantly, our vital interests do not require it. So I think that's been a consistent proposition for people that were clear-headed. And I think when we've departed from that, we made a big mistake.
Larry, this is Dan. One other thing to add to that. You know, during the Cold War, as Graham knows and Robert, we had mutually assured destruction. Perhaps what we need with China is mutually assured ambiguity to kind of encompass the kind of issues that we're talking about and living with ambiguity.
Daniel, in your new book, you talk about the important role of fracking and how it's completely upended the previous energy world that we lived in. And you also mention how electric vehicles have substantially reduced the demand for oil, making it less of an important international issue.
Not yet. Their electric vehicles are a very, very small part of the mix.
So when you hear Xi say we're going to be all electric vehicles in a few years, do you just view that as nonsense?
No, the average car in America stays on the road for 12 years. I think electric cars are going to grow. I think if Biden's president, we'll see more, you'll get more incentives to push it, more subsidies, whatever you want to call it. And I think the automakers are moving, and we hear California saying no gasoline cars after 2035, but there are 280 million cars. It's not clear what the receptivity is, and to say we're going to have electric cars in California when the power goes out with rolling blackouts raises a further question. So electric cars are coming, automakers are committed to it, but I don't think it comes anywhere near as fast. And cars, by the way, are only about 20% of world oil demand, which is, people think cars are all of oil demand, but they're about 20%.
And this audience obviously focuses greatly on U.S. energy needs. But as you mentioned, China is probably going to be our biggest user of energy in the world, and their menu of what they use is different than ours. You mentioned the importance of coal currently, and the fact it's so dirty. Al Gore movie, when he was flying over that plane, and he saw those coal plants spewing out pollution, he was very upset. How should we think about Chinese energy use, and as a climate issue, as a economic issue, and then whether or not we can use that as an ability to control Chinese power? If China is dependent upon these sea lanes, it may be less frisky in its military objectives.
Well, or I think it raises the likelihood of conflict over the sea lanes. There have already been several near collisions of U.S. and Chinese ships in the South China Sea, and that's the kind of spark that Graham expressed concern about. China, it's interesting. They have half the world's solar, they have half the world's wind, they have half the world's electric cars, but they're still building three new coal-fired plants a month. So it's sort of they're doing everything. They're cleaner than their old coal-fired plants. But, energy for China is fundamental to their vision of economic growth and, as what Graham's saying, making China great again. So it's a mixed picture. But I think the social contract, such as it exists between the party, the government, and the people, means you've got to bring down pollution. Middle class is demanding it. And so they will put greater emphasis. That's why they're importing liquefied natural gas from the United States to use gas instead of to kind of continue to push down the coal consumption.
All right, I want to wrap up the discussion of China so I can go back to education. But I'll just ask Graham, Robert, and Daniel to give me their notes of optimism, and then I can have them drop off the call. What are you optimistic about in the U.S.-Chinese relations, particularly on how we can avoid a hot war with China? Graham, why don't you start with that?
Well, I think the inescapable reality is that, and it's slightly grotesque, but that we in China are, in effect, inseparable conjoined or Siamese twins. That is, if we have a nuclear war with China, we destroy ourselves. That's what in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and I'm an old Cold Warrior, we call mutual assured destruction. And as Ronald Reagan reminded us over and over, a nuclear war cannot be won and must therefore never be fought. So that produced a huge level of constraint in the competition, even with the evil empire. We secondly have the climate impact of a China, which is the world's largest energy consumer and the largest greenhouse gas emitter. And if China can emit on its own route enough greenhouse gases to make the biosphere uninhabitable for us, and we can do the same for them. So we share some vital interest. Whether countries can be wise enough to be partners where they have to be partners for their survival, while at the same time they're fierce rivals in terms of their interests and values, you know, that's a challenge. But I believe it's a challenge we're up for. And ultimately, the test for both societies is what they can do inside their own border. So actually, if we just end on a positive note, I would say that if we as America can renew America to show that we can make America democracy work, American economy work, we have a great future. If we can't, the rest is not going to be very interesting. And ditto, if China can make their party-led autocracy work successfully, I don't believe they can over the long run. But if they can, they're going to have a great future. But it's the first and foremost battlefield is at home, and that includes things like education. So I like the link-up between the two topics that you're doing today. But when you look at the test scores, international test scores of junior high school students, high school students, university students, STEM and STEM degree students in colleges and universities, that's not a race we're winning today.
Thank you, Graham. Robert, what would you have as your concluding remarks and notes of optimism on the U.S.-Chinese relationship?
I think the notes of optimism is the U.S. and the Soviet Union had almost no trade with each other. It was a purely one-dimensional military, ideological, geographical conflict. China and the United States do so much trade with each other. There is so much conjoining economically, fiscally, that it acts as a constraint on initiating a conflict. Just one thing, a short, sharp war in the South or East China Sea lasting just a few days could tumble financial markets around the world, because the world's number one and number two economies would be in military conflict. That's something neither side wants. They're well aware that the stakes, the economic stakes for outright warfare in East Asia's adjacent seas are profound, much more profound than any conflict that we've seen since 2003 in the Middle East. So I think those will act as serious brakes on the U.S.-China conflict.
Thank you. Daniel?
First, I think to go back to the climate, just to note, China produces about twice as much CO2 every year as the United States. I think a turning point in the whole relationship between the U.S. and China, when you look back on it now, as I did in my book, is a 2008-2009 financial crisis where we lost, we ceased being the model for how you run a global economy. I think positive things, I think Robert has pointed to one, which is not let this become an ideological conflict, as I think you hear some of the rhetoric today. And the other is around the interdependence. GM sells more cars in China than it does in the United States. China holds up to $1.5 trillion of U.S. government debt. I used to think that it was a great sign for the future that there were 362,000 Chinese students studying in the United States because of what that did for bonds. But of course, that has become controversial now. But I think the note of optimism would be that interdependence will win out in given the degree of engagement between these two economies even as those other risks are there. So my optimism is around interdependence.
Great. Okay. Thank you for those speakers. And now we're going to head back and finish up with our discussion about education. I know that my co-host Rick Banks is champing at the bit. Rick, why don't you take it away?
Thank you, Larry. This is all fascinating. Let me go back to Paul Peterson to start, since you were the first speaker. Paul, you compared closing schools in the case of COVID to closing schools in the case of a flu epidemic. You rightly observed that we would never close schools because of the flu, but we are because of COVID. So in your view, how do you explain what you see as an overreaction in the case of COVID? What are the key factors that have led us to have a so much more extreme reaction than we should have? And then the second part is, how do you compare our reaction to the reaction in other countries, Canada, Mexico, our European neighbors?
Well, you know, the first encounter we had with something like COVID in the modern era, it was the Asian flu, that was the name given it, back in 1958 when I was in high school. And 200,000 people are estimated to have died in the United States, assuming a population the size that we have today, which is twice what we had back then. It was 100,000 then, equivalent to 200,000 today. We had my senior class all had our parties, our prom, our graduation exercises, our summertime festivals. There was a jamboree of all the Boy Scouts in America in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania that summer in the midst of this pandemic. Nobody paid it any attention. People just sort of said, you know, that's the way life is. There's always a risk. So I think what what's happened is people have become increasingly inclined to think that they can live a risk-free life, and people have become excessively concerned about safety over time. It's almost as if, since we don't believe in eternal life anymore, we have to believe in eternal life on this earth. And so there's a huge concern among ordinary people about this. Now, I think it's been fed by a media frenzy on this topic. So it's not like, you know, ordinary people haven't been sort of given nudges, a lot of nudges out there by the media. So I think that's definitely aggravated it. And then there's self-interest out there. There's just an enormous number of people out there who say, you know what, it's not so bad. If I don't go to work, I can work at home and I can get paid. And with our public sector, we're paying everybody whether they're working or not. And so the teacher unions have become a very serious problem in the sense that their members are getting paid whether they work or not. It's more fun to work at home than to have to go into the classroom, and the commutes can be long. And so the power of unions, you know, the teachers' unions has a political power that no other union has, because they're on both sides of the negotiating table. They play a major role in the election of school board members across the country, or they play a major role in the election of mayors across the country. For a mayor to take on a union, especially the teachers' union, it's exceedingly difficult. And you're seeing this in places around the country where mayors are trying to open the schools and they're being frustrated because the teachers' union is finding endless reasons not to do so. The air conditioning doesn't work. There's not enough ventilation. We don't know how to handle masks. We aren't prepared. How can they not be prepared? Why weren't people getting prepared last spring when the shutdown occurred and spent their whole summer getting prepared? So there's endless problems that the educational system now faces because of the genuine fear is out there. There's no doubt about that. There's a lot of people who are genuinely fearful. Now, if I want to end on an optimistic note, and I
no, we're not. We're gonna have optimism come later. You don't need to get optimistic yet.
Unfortunately, I'm gonna have to get off at this point, so I'm gonna give you my optimistic note. I think in the end, people are going to say enough is enough. I don't think the COVID's going to go away before people say enough is enough. So I think maybe my guess is shortly after the holidays, we're going to see a feeling in the country that we have to get back to normal. So thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm sorry I have to drop off at this point.
Go ahead, Paul.
Thank you. Well, let me.
I know Steve Salazar also has to drop off soon. Steve, you heard some of the comments that Laura mentioned about the role for unions. Do you want to comment a little bit about that? Steve, you're on mute.
Thank you. I think, you know, the way we talk about unions today suggests that there are conflicting interests all the time in the nature of the relationship between school districts and the unions that represent their teachers and their bus drivers and their cafeteria workers and all the range of people that run schools. Based in conflict. And I would argue that there are more common interests than conflict. Even with what we were just talking about, returning to schools, teachers have legitimate interests about how to return. And so I think if we begin thinking about our unions, our teacher unions, as assets, and instead of warring partners, we could solve a lot of these problems more creatively and much faster.
And what, you know, you highlighted the point of the collective bargaining process as in bringing teachers in to make the decisions. Why hasn't that gone national in scope? And what's the tension for that becoming the best practices?
Well, it really requires you to let go of things that have been ingrained in you. That if you were to allow teachers and believe that teachers have one role and management has another, instead of saying, you know, I know from my good teachers, they don't want bad teachers any more than I do, and accept that I'm not giving up power, I'm not ceding authority, I'm actually sharing it, and I'm taking advantage of what my teachers bring to the table on this specific issue. But most of the times they're characterized by years and years and legacy of conflict, as opposed to switching the way both management and unions think about each other and getting past historical conflicts they may have had to a new way of thinking about solving problems and really exploiting the assets that are right there in schoolhouses every day.
Laura, what do you think about Steve's proposal? Is that a viable means to address the issue of teacher retention, teacher firing?
This is Laura. Thanks. I agree with Steve about teachers unions being assets and good partners. And in fact, that's how teachers unions, at least here in California, which of course I can speak to directly, try and approach things. And I should say there's a huge variety across the country around how much due process educators get once they've earned what's often referred to as tenure. Not called that here in California, but the process. There's a lot of variation. So actually here in California, for example, we do have a process where teachers are involved, peers are involved in a couple of different ways. We have a peer assistance and review program where struggling teachers can get help from peers and professional development and like. But if there is a formal dismissal of a tenured teacher here in California, and that teacher actually elects to go to a hearing to challenge it, that hearing occurs between a three-person panel that consists of a neutral administrative law judge and two teachers. So we do have two teachers and a neutral who then decides whether there's cause to dismiss. And that's all governed by statute here in California. We don't bargain that. So none of that, in fact, we're not allowed to by statute. We're not allowed to bargain that. So it's not in our collective bargaining agreements. It's all by statute. And it actually tends to work fairly well. We've had administrators speak to this. And, you know, it does, of course, absolutely require administrators being on top of things. I mean, it's hard, you know. It requires administrators as well, you know, evaluating people early and often, you know, doing their job, holding folks accountable. I mean, it definitely requires a lot of, you know, people rolling up their sleeves and taking it seriously. But it does work well here, at least here in California. And I should say, because, you know, you hear statistics, I think maybe Aaron mentioned it, but, you know, about the low numbers, or maybe Steve mentioned this at the beginning of his talk too, the low numbers of teachers who get formally dismissed. At least in California, that obscures, though, a lot of facts. For us, the way it works is that the vast majority, when I say vast, I'm talking like 95% or more of our folks who are subject to formal dismissal proceedings, these are for these three-person, you know, panels, they settle with a resignation. They don't actually get to a hearing. So you don't, those numbers get lost because no one's tracking that, and because they never go to a formal hearing, it doesn't end up being in that final number of 8 to 11. Huge numbers who just elect to resign. We have our leaders and our chapter leaders often, you know, they help counsel folks, honestly, out of the profession. This is not for you. It's not working out. You know, too bad. That happens all the time. And our real problem, then, if I may, Rick, sorry to take up too much time on the floor here, but this segues back to, again, what I think is actually a bigger problem, at least in California, and I think it's true nationwide, and which is that we have a huge teacher shortage. We really need to figure out how we're going to recruit, support, and retain the well-trained educators. And I just worry, and I worried about this a few years ago when there's a lot of teacher scapegoating going on, that are focusing on how to fire ineffective teachers can be a distraction from bigger main challenges we face. At least, you know, here in California, 50% of teachers leave within 5 years. 50% of teachers leave within 5 years. And then the turnover rates are even higher in the high need schools. So in high poverty schools. So we really need to figure out, it's like, if you're a general going into battle and you don't have enough soldiers, you can't recruit soldiers and they leave because they don't like the conditions, and you're going into battle with not nearly enough people, and you're what's going to be your first priority? It's not going to be, oh, wait a minute, how am I going to release the, 3% of these folks who aren't effective? No, your priority is going to be like, I need to get more people. I need to retain them. I need to make sure they're well-trained, right? I think it's Linda Darling Hammond who said you can't fight your way out of the problem. You can't fire your way out of the problem.
Right. So let me pit against each other our two Stanford Law School graduates here, Laura and Aaron. Aaron, you talked about teachers' union discouraging good interventions like cash bonuses, which presumably might help with the problem of retention or even attracting people to the profession. Laura, what do you think about, one, is Aaron's characterization that teachers' unions do discourage interventions such as cash bonuses, and second, do you think that would be effective in addressing the recruitment problem?
So sometimes unions do. It's true. I mean, I referenced the equal pay for equal work objective that teachers unions have had, and transparency and pay. When you start to build in highly objective factors into compensation packages, and this is true in other industries, by the way, people get frustrated because they don't feel like they're being treated fairly. And when you have objective criteria, training and experience primarily is how it works by statute here in California, people at least know what the rules are. People are all treated the same for the work. And it's predictable and the like. Now, we have actually had here in California, at least, we've had chapters who have bargained bonuses for going to high-need schools, and that has worked. I mean, there is some willingness to do that. That can be done here. And there are other ways to incentivize, getting educators to go to the high-need schools. But there is a lot of research around that how important it is to make those schools good places to work, right? Teachers go into teaching because they care about kids, not because they want to make a lot of money. They know they're not going to make a lot of money. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be paying teachers more. We should, particularly if we want to really recruit and retain them. But they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it because they care, and you want to support them and make those schools good places to work, and they will, with good administrators. That tends to be one of the, when you survey teachers, they'll often say the number one thing is how strong is the principal at the school.
Okay. Thank you very much. Aaron, you contend that there's a tension between the interests of teachers and the interests of students. If so, what do you think should be done to reconcile or resolve or soften that tension?
Well, I don't know that there's a tension between teachers and students. I think teachers and students are typically aligned, you know, and we'll set aside, I think we focused enough on the sort of the lemons problem, the bad apples problem, you know, that's a small, but we can all agree that's a very small percentage of the teacher, and I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there's so many incredible educators who are responsible for so many, wonderful things in classrooms around the country. So I don't think it's that teachers and students are in conflict. I do think there are ways that teachers' unions are in conflict, and we've talked about some of them, but, you know, just to pick up on something that Laura mentioned, which I think is an important point, you know, I agree with Laura absolutely that we need to be focusing on the pipeline to get more great people into the teaching profession to support them and keep them in so that the attrition rate isn't as terrible as it is. But I think we have a different view on how it is that we incentivize or encourage the best and the brightest to enter and stay in the classroom, right? When I was teaching in St. Louis, this is now 12, 13 years ago, my starting salary was $30,000 a year. I would, you know, if I could still be a teacher right now, and it's the most impact I've ever made in the world on the children I taught, the 80 or 90 children that I taught in middle school. It was incredibly rewarding. But you know, I didn't leave because my school wasn't a good place to work, and it wasn't a good place to work, to be clear. That's not why I left. I left because I couldn't see a path to sustaining my family, providing for my family. And I think it's fair to say that many, you know, highly educated, well-qualified people who we, you know, love to have in our classroom, the kinds of brilliant minds we want shaping the future of America, you know, that's a very hard trade-off to ask them to make. And so you mentioned bonuses, right? This is a place where, you know, Laura mentioned there's two different kinds of bonuses we can talk about. Bonuses to encourage high-performing teachers to go to low-performing schools serving lots of black and brown kids, poor kids. You know, I think there's more alignment on that or less opposition from unions on that. But the issue where there's more opposition is how we pay teachers, how we reward the best of our teachers. Because, you know, phrases like equal pay for equal work or highly subjective factors, they suggest that, you know, teachers are basically all the same in the classroom. And if you ask any parent who's had children in schools, you know, are all of your child's teachers the same, or have some been really great and some been not as good, they would say, no, of course they're not all the same. And then if you ask them, well, you know, was what separated the good from the bad, was it training or was it years of experience, or whether they had a master's degree, there would be very little, and statistically there's very little correlation between those objective factors, and they are objective, with how much students actually learn, right? How much, you know, if you have a poor kid who enters eighth grade, as was often the case with my students, reading at a second or third grade level, right? It's the teacher who's by far the dominant factor in whether they leave still reading at a second or third grade level, or if they've made, you know, incredible progress. They get to the fourth, fifth, sixth grade level. And we ought to recognize and reward and pay those teachers like the rock stars they are. If we paid them, you know, the bonuses for that outstanding performance, if those kinds of teachers could make six-figure salaries, then, you know, people like me who are maybe in high school or college right now and want to be educators but just can't see a path might be encouraged to enter the profession and stay in the profession if that was a possibility.
Can I respond to that, Rick?
Please, yeah. Yes. Aaron's claim is that we don't have teacher pay aligned with teacher quality, and that's the problem.
Well, I think what I'm hearing him say is that there should be some merit pay, you know, and you can, that's a policy question. I mean, and I'm not going to say you can make that argument. Aaron makes it well. I think, though, there are downsides to that. You know, again, like the statutes here in California require pay based on training and experience. It's objective. It's clear. It's predictable. You don't engender bad feelings among coworkers, because the reality is we're all human beings, and we engage in nepotism and favoritism. We do, and the worry when you have kind of a merit pay system, and particularly if there isn't transparency around it, is that certain people who are, for whatever reason, are in with the administrator will maybe get paid more. We can't necessarily assume that all administrators are going to act completely rationally and fairly in deciding who gets the merit bumps. And I'll say, you know, this again is true in other industries. I mean, even when I was in a associate at a law firm, the associates preferred that associates get paid uniformly depending on what year they were at in the system, rather than baking in subjective factors that can create, you know, that or could be seen as playing favorites. So there's that. But I think even more importantly, though, is Aaron's very powerful argument around getting paid whatever $30,000 a year to be a teacher. That's not okay. I mean, teachers have college degrees. They go heavily into debt, increasingly so these days, right, to get their college degrees. And, you know, that we are not going to recruit, you know, well-educated, well-trained, highly capable, the rock stars like Aaron, if we can't pay them a lot more from the get-go. I don't think it's going to be enough to say, hey, if you, you know, become a teacher, you're going to start out really low at 30K, but if you're really awesome and your principal is really decent and recognizes you're a rock star, you'll eventually make 100K. That's not going to really bring people in. We need to, it's across the board. We need to be paying more across the board if we're really going to attract the kind of numbers and really convince people that this is a profession that is valued. I mean, I think the reality that a lot of us don't like to talk about is that, you know, teaching historically was a profession that we allowed, we let women do that work, and we didn't let women you know, do other kinds of professional jobs for a long, long time. So we kept the pay down because it was, you know, seen as women's work. And we had struggled a lot to catch up and get out of that. And teachers unions have been trying to correct that for a long time, and we're still struggling.
Just to follow up on the gender issue, I understand that the teaching profession recently has become increasingly feminine. To what extent can we incent more men to become teachers? And what is driving the increasing feminization in elementary and secondary schools?
You got to pay them more. I don't know. I mean, Aaron could probably speak to this more directly because he actually taught. Aaron, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm aligned. I think Laura and a lot what we agree on is much, much greater than what we disagree on. But what we're talking about, we agree on is not especially interesting. So let me, so you know, the sort of the theme that I heard from Laura was the problem with merit pay is that it's going to be a nepotistic system where administrators are just paying their best friends more. And if that were what merit pay were, Laura would be right. This would be a horrible way of doling out limited resources in our schools based on who the principal, who can become best friends with the principal. But virtually nobody who's serious about merit pay is proposing that, right? So the best approach that's out there is an approach been championed by the Gates Foundation through rigorous study. And it relies on three ways of determining what merit is. Like, how do we know a good teacher when, you know, do we just trust the principal? And the answer is no. Actually, that's none of the three measures, right? So one measure, it's just partial measure because there are problems with drawing on exclusively. But one measure is how much do students grow in this teacher's classroom? How much do they improve, right? So we're not punishing a teacher for having students who enter the grade level already behind in reading or math. That's not the teacher's fault, right? But if the student grows, improves by more than a grade level in that given year, that teacher has done a remarkable job. So that's one measure, right? But it's not the only one. Test scores aren't the be-all and end-all of what we do in school. So we do other things, right? We use neutral observers, not principals, right? We take videos and we send those videos to neutral observers to score how organized, how engaging the teacher is, right? It's another partial measure. And then the third measure, which I think is so important, but almost nobody's talking about, is actually student surveys, right? And again, these surveys are not, you know, do you like Mrs. Smith or Mr. Tang, right? That we could care less if the teachers like, right? But it turns out if you ask really specific questions, they tend to produce results that show which teachers are really good, right? Were you busy the entire time in Mr. Tang's class? Did you know what was expected of you, right? Did you feel challenged, right? Questions that are asking for very specific characteristics that all high-performing teachers tend to generate. And when you use this mixed system, this mixed measure, right, you reduce measurement error. And so, you know, no teacher can be like, oh, I'm actually a really great teacher, even though my students didn't learn anything this year. My students all thought they were bored and lazy, and these neutral observers said I did nothing, and I just sat at my desk. I'm actually a really good teacher, right? No teacher could say that when we have this sophisticated system. These are the kinds of measures I'd like to use. And so that, yes, you know, the first year teacher is always going to enter making less because that's the way the world works, right? Even in the NBA or the NFL, rookies get paid less based on a rookie salary scale, right? But after, you know, you've proven your worth, if you're, you know, you're Patrick Mahomes and you're in your third, fourth year and you're the NFL MVP, right, the idea that you should get paid less than, you know, 16-year backup because that 16-year backup quarterback has been playing for 16 years and you've only played 4 years, and therefore you just have to wait your time, that's not a way to run a successful profession that makes the most out of the people who enter it. We at some point have to incentivize, recognize outstanding teachers, celebrate them, reward them. That creates prestige around the profession, and I don't see any way to do that if we're just paying people who are older and who have, you know, master's degree and, you know, in whatever field.
Well, I can, two quick responses, if I may. There's a lot I could say, but one is, I think the point on your third criterion around, student evaluations, I would raise that would be an incredibly inefficient way to determine compensation for teachers. I mean, I'd be curious to know if administrators have a different view of this, but the notion that you can efficiently have principals do detailed, surveying of students in order to decide how much to pay, you know, teachers, I think that would build in a lot of inefficiencies, and student reporting is, you know, obviously a little fraught. I mean, a lot of my friends who are, you know, in academia say that the best, the professors who get the best reviews are the ones who are the easiest graders. So there's that. But I would say again that I just, in addition to just on the efficiency question, I mean, I see your point, but there is research out there that does show that experience matters in teaching. I mean, a basketball player, as you get older, you're physically not going to be as effective. So that's not true with teaching. teachers, the research does show that, generally speaking, that their performance improves over time with experience. So, you know, it is rational and efficient to compensate teachers based on their experience.
Sorry, Rick, just jump in I'll try to be really quick on that. So there is definitely evidence, right, that in the first 3 years, maybe even 5 years, right, I was a terrible teacher I was a terrible teacher my first year, right? So you're absolutely right as you get past that. But between years 5 and year 30, I'm not aware of robust evidence indicating there's any correlation between, you know, the 65-year-old teacher who's been doing it for 30 years being better than the 40-year-old. And then on the survey front, you know, this is maybe an area where there is some tension between the adults and the students, because I think the idea that we don't want to take the time to ask, you know, 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, what is going on in their education and what, you know, whether they feel like they're being challenged or engaged by their teachers, that we don't have the time for that. That sounds a little bit scary to me, right? There's just so much about the importance of encouraging participation and having students feel as though their voices are heard. And I'll pause there. I'll stop there.
I just wanted to, maybe our last question is about the use of technology. Paul Peterson mentioned earlier that he wasn't sure that technology is going to radically improve the classroom, but clearly things are changing quite dramatically. We might be able, for example, to tape the best lectures and then flip the classroom. My hope is that we can get substantial increases in productivity, and so maybe we'll be less teacher quality dependent. Maybe we'll be, we can have much larger class sizes. Maybe we can get much better results. Maybe if I could ask each of you, Aaron and Laura, how do you think technology will revolutionize the classroom and allow us to get the productivity enhancements we so much desire? Aaron, why don't you start?
Yeah, sure. I don't think it's going to revolutionize the classroom. I think this is sort of the great hope that's always out there, that, you know, with just enough technology, we can make, you know, render teachers irrelevant, and we can, you know, show the greatest lectures. So there's just an irreplaceable need for a kind, caring, engaged, passionate adult in the room, in the lives of these children. So I think we would be much, much, much better off, which is not to say that technology is irrelevant. Certainly it can help on the margins, but almost all the evidence around, for example, virtual schooling is deeply negative. And COVID is actually teaching this already, ways that, you know, especially working class Black and brown children and their families struggle. And it's not, by the way, because poor families don't have the time to read with their kids or engage them in their school. There's a really important study that showed that minority parents and poor parents are spending the same amount of time, 13 hours on average, as wealthy parents with kids during COVID, like supplementing their schooling. It's just that rich parents can do so much more than that. They can pay for school bubbles, right? They can do all these other things. Technology is not the answer. Teacher quality is the answer, and that's why this has been such an important thing for us to be talking about in this time.
This is Laura. I agree. Sorry.
Go ahead.
This is Laura. I agree with Aaron on that, and especially for the younger the student, right? You know, I mean, the younger the student, the more important it is to have that in-person interaction and support with adults in the classroom.
Okay, and with that, why don't we try to end with our moments of comment of optimism. Aaron, what are you optimistic about?
Not all that much. I guess hearing Steve talk about this success with unions working together with districts is encouraging. You know, if I had to say something, I think we are increasingly moving towards a political moment where we realize how much black and brown lives matter, and that we realize that, you know, in the criminal justice system, obviously this is a huge, huge problem, but it all starts very, very early with educational equity. So I suppose I'm hopeful that we will see a renewed commitment investment in our disadvantaged children as the biggest need in the next 4 years. But I'd be lying if I said I was especially hopeful.
Okay. And Laura?
Yeah, thanks. I'm optimistic that we've seen more folks talking about the society as a whole and how out-of-school factors like poverty, segregation, and the like are impacting, you know, student success. There's, I think, deeper and conversations going on around those issues, and that's good in terms of trying to level the playing field, right, for kids. And I'm also optimistic about the Red for Ed movement. I mean, folks have seen teachers unions across the country, including in states where they have no collective bargaining power at all, like West Virginia and the like, organizing with huge community support. I mean, the parental support has been really kind of remarkable for the educators from LA to West Virginia and elsewhere, and that gives me hope. And I think, you know, we are in a very difficult time right now, obviously, with what's going on with our economy and COVID. But I think that unions are seeing a bit of a resurgence right now, and I'm hoping that there will be renewed interest in investing in schools, investing in communities, and that unions can continue to help, you know, again, regain the middle class that I referred to earlier as being such an important part of the American dream.
Great. Rick, do you want to make any concluding remarks?
Well, I'll just say that this is a session with two very disparate topics, seemingly. But I can say without reservation that I have learned something from every speaker on this call. So thank you all for being such an extraordinary panel.
Great. With that, that concludes today's call. I just want to plug next week's call. This will focus primarily on police unions. We will also have a comedian, Matthew Friend, and the former chairman of the Chicago Fed, Michael Moscow. And with that, thank you very much. Thanks to our speakers. Thanks to our listeners, and we'll see you next week. You can disconnect now. Thank you very much for your participation. Bye-bye.